stands up straight. She rings me up. $23.92. This would cost double in the city, I say with a sly wink. She taps my hand. You're funny. She writes something in a journal next to the cash register, her bright pink nails clicking against the metal spiral binding. On impulse, I want to invite her to eat with us. Henry would kill me. He likes neither impulse nor dinner guests. I open my wallet to pay the tab, and the heat crawls up the back of my neck, flushing my face. My credit card is gone.
That reporter, he returned your wallet, yes?
We have finished eating, one remaining small sliver of venison on a ceramic platter between us. The pine farmhouse table is littered with supper cast-offs, half-empty wine and whiskey glasses, crumpled linen napkins. The dining room is dimly lit by flickering tapers, and I am sleepy drunk.
I have all but forgotten the missing credit card, and I blink twice instead of answering him.
When I arrived home, Henry called the bank immediately, shrugging it off with only a nebulous murmur of admonishment. When he hung up, he rubbed my back between my shoulder blades.
You probably just left it at the diner. I'll leave you cash.
He patted my head. Instead of being grateful, I swatted Henry's hand away. It was also patronizing. It's a blessing and a curse, having someone like Henry. On one hand, I could sit and drink a glass of wine, let him sweep in on his white horse, wave his giant hands, and fix it all with his booming voice. Take his cash, tuck it into the satin folds of my purse with a demure smile, as though I were a kept woman. On the other hand, lately I'm tired of simply letting things happen.
Cash?
Yes, he brought it back. I cross and uncross my legs.
Interesting.
Henry taps his fork against his plate, a quiet ting in the silent room. The silence up here, hovering on the top of this mountain, kills me.
You think he took it?
I'm incredulous. That had never crossed my mind.
Henry shrugs. I'd have no idea, Zoe. We don't know the man.
Well, I know him a little. He doesn't seem like a thief. He's a reporter.
Ah, yes, an honorable bunch.
He pulls his mouth down into an ironic frown that also seems almost like a grin.
It's just something to think about, that's all. That man, he's around a lot when all these things seem to be happening.
The bottle of table red has worked a number on me. I've drunk the bottle alone while Henry nursed a glass of Pomerol he brought up from the cellar. Henry leans back in his chair, his lips lifted at the corners. His hair uncharacteristically mussed, flopping down over one eye. He looks boyish. Henry never looks boyish. He holds up one finger like he's forgotten something. He pushes himself up and comes around to my side of the table. He perches, one leg up, smoothly sliding my dinner plate to the side. From his pants pocket, he retrieves a small velvet box and sets it gently in front of me with a wry smile. On top of the box sits a small card. No envelope. I flip it open. As you are woman, so be lovely. As you are lovely, so be various. Merciful as constant, constant as various. So be mine, as I yours forever.
Henry.
I can't stop the smile. It's all so unlike him.
Poetry? Did you write this?
Of course not. It's part of a Robert Graves poem. I've always loved it.
He touches his finger to his lips, his thumb poised under his chin, and gives me a look of reflection. I open the lid, and nestled inside the pink velvet folds is a bracelet. The chain is intricately braided yellow and white gold, and it sparkles in the candlelight. At first blush, I think it is a charm bracelet, which seems uncharacteristically trendy of Henry, and I give him a questioning look. The chain threads through three beads. I unclasp the hooks on either end and delicately hold the jewelry in my palm.
It's pretty, I say, feeling like I probably don't understand the significance. I'm not lying. It is pretty. It's just not Henry's style. Too simple, too trendy. It's more my style. Then again, Henry is often thoughtful in ways I am not. I study the beads. The first one is engraved with a small, squat tree, its branches reaching up and wrapping around the gold. The etching is delicate and fine, and the detail takes my breath away. The second bead is carved with a simple flower, what looks to be a gladiolus. The third bead contains a set of wings, each feather intricately scored.
Very beautiful. I nod my head as though I understand it.
Henry watches me with amusement, his eyes crinkling at the corners.
Oh, stop. I'm not fooled. I can read you, you know.
Well, then, explain it, I laugh. He fastens the bracelet around my wrist. His hair tickles my cheek.
I had these made. The tree is because you give me roots. I want to do the same for you. The tree is actually a bonsai. The Japanese believe that when left in nature, the bonsai grows wild and unruly and ugly. That only when carefully cultivated by people is it beautiful.
Am I the bonsai? I have always felt like Henry's pet project. To some extent, Lydia wasn't far off. I've been groomed to fit into his life, among his friends and colleagues. He laughs and kisses my nose.
I am the bonsai, Zoe. Without you, I am an angry, singly driven man, a man with one purpose. I become one of those loveless rich men. I become Crable.
I lean back and study Henry as he speaks. It's surprising how well vulnerability suits him. It's the sexiest thing he's ever worn. Go on. I tilt my head.
The wings are easier to explain.
He touches the bead on the end. His thumb massages my palm.
I'm sorry. I have no desire to hold you back. I fell in love with your grit. These past few months I've been afraid of losing you. I've clipped you too much, and I'm sorry.
We're both damaged. I run my index fingernail over the veins in the top of his hand, his smooth, large-knuckled hands. I love his hands. He clears his throat and holds the center bead between his thumb and index finger, his hands cool on my wrist.
The middle bead is a gladiolus.
The flower of infatuation. My voice hitches.
Yes, technically, love at first sight. Which is us, don't you think?
He stands up, tugs on my hands until I stand with him.
It's also a symbol of character and strength. It reminded me of you.
He steps back, rubs his forehead, and gives me a sideways smile. It's beautiful, Henry. Which is cliched and stupid, but I'm speechless.
I want you to go back to the flower shop. I'm saying it's okay.
He tugs on my hand, leading me away from the table, through the living room and up the wood steps. I follow him, swaying slightly, tilting my wrist in the moonlit living room to get a closer look at the bracelet. I can't believe he'd thought of all that, and I have no idea when he'd had it made. It means more to me than all the diamonds and rubies in our safe. Without warning, the want creeps up on me. I gently push on the small of his back down the hall and into our bedroom, where I shove him, wanton and drunk, onto the bed. We pull at each other's clothes, and I am laughing. The room spins, and the next morning, when I try to remember the moment, all I can see is Henry's smile, the love reflected in his blue eyes, and the overwhelming feeling that here in this secluded country, despite all his flaws and our imperfections, where I know not another soul, I am home. Chapter 12. On Saturday, I'm up at 6, brewing coffee in a stainless steel percolator, standing at the gas stove watching coffee gurgle and spit into the glass top. I can't sleep. In our penthouse apartment, we hear very little street noise, so I can't figure out the difference. But I had lain in bed, my leg jittering, shifting one way, then the other, before I finally snuck out and downstairs. Arms snake around my middle and I jump. You scared me. I smile, my head tipped down, and Henry plants a feather kiss on the back of my neck.
Ah, sorry, he whispers in the dark kitchen. Don't be mad, but I have to drive back for a few hours.
Today? I step forward, putting distance between us.
I'm sorry. It's going to be overcast, but not rainy. You could hike out back. There are trails. They're not all ours, but no one cares. Just don't get killed by a hunter.
What season is it, I wonder? He rubs his jaw.
Spring turkey, maybe? I'm not sure. I generally hunt in the fall. Spring is too busy with work.
I don't understand Henry's work or his hunting. It's completely possible, likely even, that I don't understand Henry. I pour us two cups of coffee in pottery mugs, but as I turn to retrieve the cream and sugar, for mine only, Henry drinks his coffee black. Henry's eyebrows pucker, his mouth twisting apologetically.
You have to go now, I say, flat as stone, and sigh.
I pick up his mug and pour the coffee into the carafe. He drops a kiss on my lips and lingers there, his hand pressed between my shoulder blades.
Don't pout. I'll be back right after lunch. I just have to address some unexpected issues.
Issues with what? I'm curious now. What are the issues on a Saturday if you work on Wall Street?
Zoe, do you know how boring my job is?
No, tell me. Put me back to sleep, and I'll sleep till you come back. He laughs, and the sound swallows me. I love it and miss it all at once.
Okay, fine. So, Japan's market is not actually closed on Saturday, and we have a security issue with the agency bonds.
Okay, okay. I feel like you just made all that up. Go. I give his arm a gentle shove, and he laughs again. I think it's possible that this house, this town, has let out a new Henry, like he's been unzipped. I picture him stepping out of his own skin, clapping his hands together, looking around.
Okay, what do we do first? Fish? Hunt? Hike?
He kisses his fingertips and touches them to the crown of my head, and I hear his shoes clack on the hardwood floor and the door click shut. And just like that, I'm alone. I'm not necessarily afraid, but I have a pit settled right under my breastbone. I'm at loose ends. It's hard to have a whole day in front of you and nothing to put in it. Nothing to pencil in, no phone calls to make. I have this feeling often, but generally I can fill my time by going out, taking in Manhattan. In New York, you're never bored. I look at the clock above the sink. 6:30. I part the curtains. Out leads to a forest in the back and a copse of trees in the front. Then, a quarter mile away, a road. I take my mug, and from the back of the easy chair in the living room, I grab a sweater that I assume must be Henry's, but I don't recognize it. It's heavy and cable-knit. Its sleeves are long with big wooden buttons. I wrap it around myself tightly and open the back door. The deck is wide and spans the back of the house, looking out to a sea of black and green. In the corner is a single rocker made of rough-hewn logs, a deliberate attempt to look woodsy. I curl into it, bring my knees to my chest, and cup my coffee. It's cold for April. I doubt today will be a day for exploring the outdoors. It smells like wet pine. I'm reminded of Lake Tahoe. Evelyn had nabbed a cabin once, a gift from a friend. She had a million gifts from friends. She didn't have any money, but always said she had a lot of friends, and some of those friends had money. She'd come home with steaks that she'd gotten as a gift, or wine she found. All trinkets that people gave her, she claimed. She'd explain it away with a wave of her hand and a soft, tinkling laugh. You can get anything you want if you're nice to people. People like to do things for people. It's so easy to be kind. She dragged me to Tahoe, where the rich vacation, she'd said. We'll be queens for a week. My 17-year-old heart had nearly broken at the idea of a week without television and very little phone communication. I dragged my feet. I huffed and puffed, whatevering my way through half the trip, sneaking calls to friends when Evelyn wasn't looking.
Evelyn never faltered, her grin bright, coral lipstick smudged on her two front teeth when she smiled, which was all the time. It's easy to glorify the dead and say things like that. Oh, they glowed. They were always happy. With Evelyn, it was true. Any attitude I threw at her that week, it's like she caught it all with Jergen's soft hands and never stumbled. She unmoored the boat, a ramshackle rowboat that I insisted would sink.
So what?
She'd scoffed. We can swim, right? And paddled us out into the middle of the lake with one oar, one side, then the other. Her cheeks had grown bright red, and I thought she might pass out. I'd rolled my eyes and took the paddle from her. Don't die, Ev. And her arms had looked so thin. It was the first time I'd realized she'd grown so incredibly tiny. God, Evelyn, you're a stick. Eat a sandwich or something. I knew I was being mean, but it would be so embarrassing to have an anorexic mother, like one of the fainting cheerleaders at school. She leaned over the side of the boat and swatted a handful of water at me. I took the oar and, with a sweeping motion, drenched her. She laughed, but it sounded like it came from inside a barrel. She looked away, and when she looked back, she bared her teeth.
Do I have lipstick?
For the first time, she didn't. We'd made it back to the cabin where we blasted Billie Holiday and simmered vodka sauce, and she let me drink wine until the edges of the room blurred. She got me to talk about boys, or who I thought were men at the time.
Don't be afraid of sex. Be afraid of love, but not sex. Love can swallow you whole, consume you, change you. But sex? Sex is just for a night.
And I had no idea what she meant. Later, I heard her on the phone in her room. I stood in the hallway of that cabin, and I swore she was crying. I pushed against her bedroom door, but couldn't hear the words. She was sick then, and it was only after she'd died that I realized she'd known it. A thought nags at me, one I'd asked Mick, filled with hate and anger. If she had so many friends, where were they? When she died, where'd they go? No one called. No one offered to pay for a simple cremation. I'd stayed in her apartment for weeks after her death, that foggy, milky time before I ran. But never once did the phone ring unless a bill collector was on the other end. I searched my memory for who Evelyn said was the cabin's rightful owner, and come up empty. The sky has lightened to a dove gray, and the rain mists all around, not falling in drops from the sky, but like it's raining from the bottom up. My coffee cup is empty, and I'm cold. I venture inside and look at the clock. It's not even 9. I wander upstairs half-heartedly to find my book buried under sweaters and jeans in my overnight bag. All the doors in the hall are closed, and I nudge open the one next to our bedroom. The bed in the center is made simply, and a hand-stitched, brightly colored patchwork quilt adorns the bed. The pillows are made from old jeans pockets, and the walls are adorned with red wooden stars, an upmarket Americana theme. I am sure of two things. Penny decorated this room, not Henry, and nothing has changed since Tara died. Upon closer inspection, the bureau top contains bottles of women's perfume, turned yellow in the sun. The nightstand holds a mystery book with page 137 folded down at the corner. There are blue peep-toe bedroom slippers. Chanel makes bedroom slippers? Peeking out from under the bed. She could have been here yesterday. Then there is the dawning realization that there's not the slightest layer of dust on anything. It's not as though this room has been closed off, never to be entered again. Someone cleans this room, rearranges the perfume bottles just so, moves the slippers to vacuum and replaces them so that their toes line up perfectly underneath the dust ruffle. My arms are pricked with goose flesh. I back out of the room and close the door, my hand paused over the doorknob. I am at once anxious to leave and glued to the spot. My desire to know more about the woman Henry was married to battles some unknown restraining force. I try to pinpoint it, and can't, but suspect I fear measuring up.
It's hard enough to keep pace with an ex-wife when the relationship was permitted to slide downward on its own. But I suspect Tara was ripped from Henry's arms at the peak of his adoration. And yet, I still bumble along somewhere in the middle. It's a hard thing to know that you're second. I leave the room and turn to examine the other two rooms. The door at the end of the hall is Henry's office. The door between what I've so quickly come to think of as Tara's room and his office is padlocked. Padlocked? I half-heartedly give the doorknob a good jimmy, but unsurprisingly, it doesn't move. I do the same to Henry's office, and am startled to realize that that door doesn't open either. It's been locked from the inside. My phone buzzes from inside my pocket, and a text from Cash blinks. Give me a call ASAP. I sent you an email. I check my service and see that there's no data, only one unsteady bar of network service. When I open the web browser, the loading circle spins around and around. I jam my phone back in my pocket. Stupid in the middle of nowhere land. The house doesn't have wireless, but I vaguely remember Henry assuring me his office computer had internet access. I jimmy the handle again for good measure. I pull my phone back out and dial Henry. It rings 4 times and goes to voicemail. Henry, it's me. Where's the key to your office door and why is it locked? I want to use the internet. Call me back. There's only one reason that Cash would be calling me, and it has to do with my birth mother. I'm sure he's found something, and my heart pounds. I clatter down the steps and dig through the kitchen drawers until I unearth a screwdriver. Back upstairs, I stick the screwdriver through the old-fashioned keyhole and wiggle it around until I feel it catch the lock. It takes me a few minutes, but after the 3rd try, the mechanism clicks backward and the handle gives. I pause, with my hand on the door. I've never been in Henry's office before, and now I'm doing this without his permission. The office smells of the one leather chair with a faint overtone of sawdust. Henry's desk is a simple Quaker-style table with a single middle drawer, so unlike his offices at home and work, which boast rich mahogany and more drawers and cabinets than he could possibly fill. The house was his family's, and I wonder if this was his father's office. Later I'll ask him when he's properly plied with whiskey. He's said very little about his parents, and I scan the room for signs of them. Nothing. I pull out the chair and sit, hitting the power button on the computer. The desktop is a surprisingly old Mac, nothing at all like the sleek silver laptops Henry carts around, always the newest, smallest model. I briefly wonder if the office is even his. I wonder what Tara did for a living. I'm surprised but grateful that the computer doesn't prompt me for a password to log on. I click the internet icon and it takes a minute, but it chugs to my email site. I call Cash back. Hi, it's me. I'm at a computer. What's up? I'm breathless and I realize my fingers are shaking. Hey, hold on. He covers the phone, and I hear voices and then scratching like he's got the phone in his pocket. After a minute or so, he comes back. Okay, did you check your email? Yeah, it's open. I sent you a link. Click on it. I do, and it brings me to a genealogy tracing website with Evelyn at the top of the page. Her picture knocks the wind out of me. Her smile is bright. She looks so young. I don't realize I'm crying until a tear hits my forearm. I sniff.
Are you okay?
Cash asks. I realize I've been quiet too long. I'm fine, but what is this? How do they have her picture?
She must have made a profile. When was this picture from?
I study it and realize that based on her weight, she was probably already sick, maybe in her first remission. Maybe 6 or 7 years ago, she was already sick.
Okay, scroll down until you see the name Janice Reeves.
He's clicking in the background. I do what he says.
Do you see the names under her?
Gail, Belinda, Caroline, I say out loud. Then again, Caroline.
It's a hunch, not a fact yet. I wanted your feedback. He talks quickly, the words piling out in a rush. But the name on the birth certificate is Carolyn, with a Y, and the last name is Seaver.
Remember how I said no one makes up a truly fake name?
I can't breathe. Cash, is this really her? Were they cousins?
I don't know. There's no picture. You have to create a profile to get a picture.
But, Zoe, I sent you another link. I click back to my email and click on the second link. I don't prepare myself. I don't think about it. I just click. And when the page opens, the room tilts. Oh my God. Cash. It's a Facebook page. A woman staring defiantly into the camera with a twisted mouth, a coy smile, daring the world. Her eyes are twinkling, that pale translucent blue that I recognize. Her hair is dark and unruly in spots, glossy in others. And I bet she has a hell of a time finding good product for it. Her nose is straight with an identifiable ridge, and her left eyebrow shoots up noticeably higher than her right. Like mine. It's all like mine. It's my face, aged 20 years. It's her. You've found her. For the rest of the day, I keep going back to the office and staring at the computer, at that picture. That sassy, smart-aleck face. The expression I recognize, but maybe haven't seen in a long time. I have the vague recollection of making that exact face for a picture during a night out with Lydia. In the bathroom mirror, I try to imitate it, pulling my mouth to the side, arching my already asymmetrical eyebrow. Back in the office, I download the picture and email it to myself. I stretch and look around the room. On the far wall, there are built-in bookcases, floor-to-ceiling with books. Old, new, hardcover paperback thrillers and mysteries. Ruth Rendell, Dennis Lehane, Ross MacDonald, Arthur Conan Doyle. I run my finger along the shelving and wonder if they, too, are Tara's. The eye-level shelf holds knick-knacks and picture frames, and I realize with a start that there's a simple black frame that holds a picture of me. I'm sitting on a rock, overlooking a stream, wearing a violet shirt and a pair of khaki shorts. I remember that day, the hike at Breakneck Ridge. It was a strenuous hike, and I was panting by the top, hot and out of breath, out of shape. A breeze was lifting my hair while Henry snapped pictures with his Canon at the summit. I remember him finding the spot for the photo, off the main trail, to a sketchy side path, overgrown and treacherous. Claiming he wanted pictures of me for his office, at work, and in our apartment, something he could look at. I protested, pushing my bangs off my forehead, my hands on my flaming cheeks. It was September, the leaves still green, the air still humid. I remember him helping me down from the steep rock, the way he pushed me against the closest tree without saying a word, pawing at my clothes, wanting me. His hands everywhere, his mouth hot and gasping. I remember the way the bark scratched my bare back as he thrust, only twice, before he fell against me, his body limp and panting. I remember being surprised by the need, the sharp, tangible desperation as he whispered, "I'm sorry," into my hair. I had teased him about it later, and he growled at me, "It's only because you're so goddamn beautiful." He'd pulled me against him so I could feel how he was still ready, and he softly bit my neck. I take the picture over to the desk and hold it up next to the picture on the computer. If not for the age difference, we could be twins. Chapter 13. I'm still staring at the computer when my phone rings in my hand. I jump and answer it without looking, assuming it is Cash. Instead, it is Henry.
"Who did you think it was?" he asks, ruffled after my distracted, "Oh."
"No one. I thought it was you. I'm sorry, I'm on the internet. Hey, why was your office door locked?" My tone is accusatory and I silently chastise myself. Catch more flies with honey, an Evelyn favorite.
"Oh, was it? Habit, I guess. I sometimes rent out the house and I lock some of the doors. I don't need people going through everything. The key is in the kitchen on the key hook. It's an old skeleton key. He clears his throat.
Okay, I jimmied it open. If you don't want people in there, you should get a padlock, like the other room.
There is a beat of silence.
That room has old client files.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm on my way back. I'll be there in a half hour or so. Dinner?
Sure. I check the clock on the wall. Somehow it is 4 o'clock. I've literally killed a whole day staring at a picture. My head pulses and I realize I haven't eaten anything.
Is there a restaurant in this town?
Henry laughs.
This town is 90% Italian. There's the best homemade Italian food you've ever had, inside or outside of the city.
Vacation Henry is back. I laugh with him. Then,
hurry home, I say coyly, and we hang up.
I can't stop staring at her. I blow the picture up and use the scroll bars to move across her face. Her right eye is slightly larger than the other. A thin scar slivers her forehead close to her hairline. Her ears are double pierced, but she only has earrings in one set of holes. With each new discovery, I race to the bathroom and examine my face. I have a tether. My head hurts, and I'm tired of thinking about Caroline, of analyzing her. On a whim, I navigate to Google and type in the first line of the poem on the card from Henry. As you are woman, so be lovely. Pygmalion to Galatea by Robert Graves. Pygmalion. The Greek sculptor who fell in love with his statue. Henry is typically not overly literate nor self-reflective. Poetry and fiction are time wasters, and self-reflection is a hallmark of self-doubt. I'm still sitting at the computer when I hear his car pull in the driveway. I shut it down quickly and stand up. The blood rushes to my head and my vision swims. We meet in the hallway and we both laugh.
Hi.
Hi.
He dips me back a bit and kisses me hungrily on the lips. I kiss him back, but distractedly. I haven't had time to think about what to tell Henry, if anything. He'd hinted at wanting some distance between Cash and me. I'm hesitant to tell him that he helped me find Caroline, especially considering his reaction at my wanting to find her in the first place. I need to handle it delicately, so I push it all away, bury it in my mind. It's too easy to get caught up in Henry's buoyancy. His hair is tousled from the drive like he's had the car window open. His face shines from the misty air, his cheeks puffed and pink.
Go get dressed.
He pats my bottom and gives me a wink. I skip step into the bedroom and pull open my suitcase.
Oh, I brought something for you.
He's holding out a hanger and a bag. I unwrap a simple straight sheath dress, black with tiny silver faux buttons up the back.
Where did you get this? I ask him, eyebrows raised.
He shrugs and gives me a lopsided smile.
I bought it a while ago, but I've just been looking for the right occasion to give it to you. We'll be hopelessly overdressed.
Better over than under, I say. Another Evelynism. Evelyn, who would wear her Sunday best to the grocery store just for fun, complete with hat.
You only live once, you know? And who knows, maybe someone will think we're really somebodies.
I slip on the dress and it fits like a glove. Henry always knows my exact size, even if it fluctuates due to brand. When I turn around to face him, he hands me a pair of simple black slingbacks, an impeccable compliment to the dress. I cock my head to the side.
What, are you surprised?
He shakes his head, a curved smile playing on his lips.
Always.
I snatch the shoes and slide them on, wiggling my toes. I bounce back and forth on the balls of my feet. The day has energized me, filled me with nervous anticipation. I've sworn not to think of her, but I find myself wondering what she'd make of me, of this whole scene, this rich, powerful husband of mine who buys me clothes in the perfect size, in a style he likes, even though I hadn't stopped to ask myself if I liked it. I give a twirl in the mirror and decide that I do. I wouldn't have picked it, but then again, some of my favorite pieces come from Henry's mind. The man knows how to dress a woman. Feeling daring and unlike myself, I whistle at him.
He turns, and with a quick movement, I shimmy out of my panties and toss them on the bed. He lifts a brow, his mouth bowed down in surprise.
Well now, dinner should be interesting.
The restaurant is small, one waitress and 10 tables. Only 4 are filled. The room is dark, lit by flickering candles and twinkling white lights that are absorbed by the maroon tablecloths draped over 2 top, round tables. Everyone knows one another on a familial level. The Sartinis, the Petruccis, the Tomassis, they descend on us newcomers like a flock of seagulls. Fishing Lake used to be a textile town, Henry explains. 2 mills flanked the small community, attracting hundreds of Italian immigrants in the early 1900s. When they both closed in the early 70s, the population divided. 1 half-bedroom community commuters with long drives into the city, and the other half-descendants keeping up the remaining tourist industry. A small restaurant, a bakery, a corner store, a rental management company.
My father was the former, he tells me, a lawyer commuting into New York.
I hold my breath. He hardly mentions his parents. I know they are dead. Henry has mentioned a car accident. I tried to relate. My own father died in a car accident, I said at the time, but he'd brushed me off.
Mr. Whittaker was a wonderful man,
stage whispers a man from the table next to us. He is small, his shoulders hunched into the table. His hands are large and his knuckles misshapen. He claws a fork that shakes over his plate of ziti.
My boy got in trouble. That boy was always in trouble. Mr. Whittaker saved his hide plenty of times.
His eyes twinkle and he nods at Henry.
But he knew how it was to have a troublemaker son.
He shakes his index finger at Henry. Henry smiles at the man.
Were you a troublemaker? I tease coyly.
Henry smiles and rolls his eyes in the man's direction.
That's Mr. Zappetti.
His mind, Henry says and taps his temple with his middle finger. The man shakes his hand in Henry's direction and laughs.
You kids,
the man turns to me.
My son, he's a good citizen now, just like your Henry. The wild boys, they run wild.
Henry is pulled into another conversation. The men, they want his advice on their investments. The women compliment my dress and ooh and ah when I tell them Henry bought it as a surprise. They cluck and raise their eyebrows when I order white wine.
What's wrong with the red?
And when I remind them which house is Henry's, Mrs. Zulo, a tiny gray tuft of a woman, nods knowingly and clicks her tongue.
That's the old Bizzini place.
She raps the table with her knuckles, and all the tables around us say, oh, in unison.
That old strega, she died in that place, you know.
Her husband elbows her.
Vita mia, hush now, that was 40 years ago.
I look over at Henry, who is 40 years old, and wonder when they moved there. Where did he live before? So much to learn about my husband, so much I don't know. It's odd, I realize, to have this much blank space in a marriage, this broad of a canvas to fill in. Maybe. I don't know. This is my first one. His foot touches mine under the table. Mrs. Sartini, as round and wobbly as Mrs. Zulo is small, shakes her finger at us.
Mrs. Vicini, she died of a broken heart, left by a man at 50. Zitella.
The crowd breaks up laughing. I don't know what Zitella means, but even Henry tips his head back in belly laughter. I can't stop checking my phone. For what? I'm not sure. Another email from Cash, another picture of her. The clock creeps toward 9, and one by one the tables empty with bids of good night and nice meeting you, and 2 friendly cheek kisses, until Henry and I are finally alone. His fingers tickle my thigh and I shift away.
What did you do today?
His eyelids are drooping, sleepy drunk, and he has a dopey smile on his face.
Not so fast. You were a troublemaker, I prod, tapping his toe with mine.
He waves his hand, annoyed.
Mr. Zappetti is a storyteller. No, I was not a troublemaker.
I was a kid. I think we soaked his windows one Halloween.
I cover my mouth with my hand.
Hey, it's tough to entertain yourself in this town, he protests, his eyes shining. Tell me what you did today, he says again, smiling.
My mind goes white. I hesitate, my hand fluttering above my wine glass. All at once, I remember Caroline, her arched eyebrow, her dark wild hair, her mischievous eyes. Then,
aren't I enough?
I can't do it. I can't kill the evening, break this spell. I picture his smile fading, his posture straightening, how he would adjust his collar or clear his throat. He'd say something so Henry, like,
I thought we discussed this before, Zoe. Or, you found your birth mother on Facebook?
As though it were laughable and it would be diminished. Instantly reduced in the way that only Henry can, with a flick of his wrist or a twist of his lips. Then we'd sit in silence, I'd clear my throat, and he'd throw back the rest of his wine, and we'd leave. No, no, no. Henry looks so happy and free, his shoulders loose and the furrow between his eyebrows is smoothed. Not much, I say, deflecting. I read a book by Ruth Rendell, a mystery novel. Have you read her? I twirl a fork between my fingers. I'm fishing. Henry scratches his chin and looks up at the ceiling.
I don't think so.
Really? You have one of her books on the nightstand in the other bedroom, I say, and raise one eyebrow, an expression I excel at.
Oh, well, he says flippantly, that was Tara's room. She read voraciously.
Oh, the guest room was Tara's bedroom? I'm not exactly feigning surprise. I hadn't expected him to be so blunt about it.
She would sleep there sometimes. I worked late. She liked to go to bed early. I suppose it sounds odd now. It seemed so normal at the time.
I picture a Brady Bunch relationship, chaste kisses on the cheek while he brought her chamomile tea and McVitie's biscuits, pats on the cheek, making love in the dark, missionary style. No, I think it's fine. I just had no idea. I take a deep breath, the words stuck on my tongue. Henry, I don't know anything about her. He leans back in his chair.
She was very different than you. Very timid. A bit scared of the world. You wonder why I don't know what to do with you.
He laughs and I relax back in my seat. Do you keep that room hers? I cock my head to the side and study his face. He averts his eyes, squinting at a grapevine wreath on the far wall.
Not intentionally, Zoe. I don't come here much anymore. Do you know that we used to spend every weekend here?
He shakes his head and chooses his words carefully.
It's hard to come back sometimes.
You still love her. I feel stupid even as I say it. It's so obvious I'm not even sure if there's anything wrong with it. Why wouldn't he? She never gave him a reason not to, except for the simple fact that she's gone. His love for me, then, is by default. I've broken the spell anyway, and for the wrong thing.
It's complicated.
He sighs.
It's not like a divorce. I didn't have any control over the end of my marriage.
He rests his cheek against the L of his thumb and forefinger and studies me.
Is that hard for you?
Not usually. But we've been married nearly a year and we've never had this conversation. That's hard for me. This was the kind of talk that we should have had a million times, drinking wine wrapped in blankets on a cold winter night. The kind of close, furtive confidences of lovers, whispered kisses and shared breath.
The room is not a shrine to Tara. I guess I'm lazy. I rent this house out, just a few times a year in the summer and again in the fall to hunters.
His eyes flick across my face. You've never been called lazy in your life, I joke. Half joke. The room is fuzzy, and I feel coquettish, preening, looking up at Henry from under my eyelashes.
You call me out, Zoe. I never knew how much I would love that. I've certainly never had it before.
For something to do, I pour another glass of wine. I realize I've drunk almost the whole bottle of white alone.
and I slosh more than a sip full down the side of the goblet and onto the tablecloth, which I then rub with the pad of my thumb.
"It's not a shrine," he repeats. "It's just easier. I have a new life, I'm remarried. Sometimes it's like I've lived twice. I wonder if she ever existed at all. That room is physical proof, that's all. I don't think about it, I don't go in there. Do you want me to change it? I will."
He blows out a breath, and it tumbles across the table, warm and sweet.
"I'm not preserving it. It's just that I haven't changed it, that's all. Do you see the difference?"
He seems desperate for me to understand now, his hands splayed out across the tablecloth, and I feel a stab of guilt.
"Why is it so goddamn spotless?"
I laugh, my voice slurring on the word spotless, so it sounds like spice. He pretends not to notice.
"I had it cleaned last weekend. I had the whole house cleaned. Penny does all the rooms before I come out."
"Penny?" I sit up straight. For some reason, this fact gets under my skin and sits there like a fat, well-fed tick. He had Penny clean the house last weekend? He'd made the trip seem spontaneous, a reaction to the break-in.
"Sure. Who else?"
He tops off my glass with the last of the bottle.
"But you made it seem like this was a last-minute trip," I protest weakly. I can't find the right words.
"What does that matter? I was thinking about surprising you. Is that a crime? Then the break-in happened and it seemed like an opportunity. Jesus, Zoe, are you always so exacting?"
"I don't know what that means." My stomach roils.
"I just mean you need to know every little thought, and if it doesn't align with the script in your head, I'm the bad guy."
"You're not the bad guy." I push away from the table roughly and the table wobbles. "You're not a bad guy."
I mumble something about the bathroom. I concentrate very hard, walking in a straight line with my head up as though I'm perfectly fine. I find the ladies' room in the dark back corner of the restaurant. Inside, I lean against the door, the room spinning and whipping around me. I feel along the wall and flip the light switch. Without warning, my stomach heaves and I retch into the toilet. The tile floor is cold on my legs, and I remember that I'm naked under my dress. I feel my face flame red. God, did I think I was 20 years old? I'm just a second wife living someone's second life at 30.
I wipe my bottom lip with the back of my hand and push myself up to standing. The room has stopped spinning, and I smooth the front of my dress down with my hands. I feel better, at least like I could walk across the room. I wash up and rinse my mouth. I slowly make my way back to the table.
"Are you all right?"
Henry leans forward and takes my hand.
"I drank too much," I say plainly.
Henry smiles, teasing me.
"Let's get you home."
I lean on Henry and he leads me out. I remember saying earlier that it would be good for us to walk. The spring air is cold on my arms and the night is black and quiet, the kind of quiet that seems to absorb sound. Our footsteps are silent. I occasionally laugh, and it sounds muted, like coughing into a pillow. I concentrate on walking straight, as to not give away my level of drunkenness. I'm reminded of the countless nights stumbling home, my arm linked through Lydia's as we leaned on each other. We'd whisper and giggle and bump hips as we walked, her hair in my face smelling of cherry candy and cigarettes. I lean close to Henry and wrap my hands around his arm. His bicep bumps and flexes under his cotton shirt. I nuzzle his neck and he smells like the ocean, fresh and salty. At home, I peel my dress off and lie on the bed, the fan moving the air across my skin. Henry runs the bath, the pipes creaking and groaning under the floor. The water rushes up the wall all around me until it sounds like it's coming from inside my head. He calls my name from the bathroom.
"I'll be right there," I whisper, and then I giggle because I know I'm lying.
I wave in his direction, the diamond on my left hand catching the dim light and throwing prisms on the wall. I fan my fingers in front of me and study the ring, a solitary glittering stone the size of a marble. If I squint my eyes,
It looks like there are two of them.
Chapter 14. Washington Square Park, desolate and gray in the winter months, is lush with life come April. Aging beatniks loaf on the grass, retirees challenge children to a competitive game of chess, mothers sit on park benches with their e-readers, rocking baby carriages with one foot. NYU students take to the park in droves, studying the human condition for psychology, sociology, and film classes. The park bursts with budding cherry trees and barely contained hope. It is Monday. Vacation Henry is back to work Henry, buttoned up and pressed, heavy on the starch. I'm back to reality. My credit card is still not functional, and Henry has promised to call the bank. He's left me $100 in cash on the counter for daily expenses, which feels both extravagant and oppressive. I could surely ask him for more, I reason. But for what? I've called Yates twice, who tells me nothing. She sighs into the phone, a tap-tap-tap of her acrylic nails on a keyboard coming through the line. She talks a good game, tells me all the things they've done, but that everything is inconclusive. Penny has an alibi, and besides, what on earth could her motive be? The hazard pay? Henry wasn't a fan of that joke. Henry has changed the apartment locks. We are safely sequestered in our tower again. I should feel more relieved than I do. Away from Fishing Lake, with nothing else to think about, the burglary being inconclusive and all, the idea of finding Caroline has trumped all else. Cash sits on a bench in the middle to discourage company and is heavily involved in a paper bag. His forehead is ridged in concentration, his heavy bottom lip protruding out, curling back against his chin as he works at a hangnail on his thumb with his teeth. I peek at the cover before he sees me. As I lay dying. When he sees me, he stashes the book under his left thigh and scoots over, patting the boards next to him. I sit, my purse primly on my lap, a good foot between us. Faulkner? I can't help but tease. He shrugs.
You're so surprised? Because why? My muscular physique?
His eyebrows waggle Groucho style and I laugh. He's flirting with me. I sit up straight and he clears his throat, holding out a manila file folder in my direction.
So, because you dragged me all the way to the village for some unknown godforsaken reason, I brought you this.
He hands me the folder and I open it. You live in the village, I remind him with a smirk. A picture of Caroline Reeves glosses under my fingertips. She is making another playful face into the camera, her lip curled in mock anger. Her eyes twinkling, her mouth curved up in a half-smile, a pronounced double V on the bridge of her wrinkled nose. Someone else's hand rests on her shoulder. In the background glitters a Ferris wheel. Underneath the picture are two typed pages of information. She has a family. She lives in Danbury, Connecticut. I do the math. She had me when she was 17. A fresh stab of rejection lands right under my sternum. I'd expected, somehow, my birth mother to still be wallowing in her 30-year-old decision, pale and gaunt with greasy hair and a listless expression. But she's not. She's moved on, and, judging by her fun-loving online presence, quite happily. Cash rubs his knees with his palms and looks around, his posture inches forward like he's going to get up. Wait, I say. I open my mouth to ask how he got all this information, but instead I hear myself say, "Will you come with me?"
"Where?"
He looks startled. I shrug, knowing it's a bad idea. I think of driving alone and my stomach clenches. Truthfully, I'm so sick of going alone.
"Yeah, of course, Zoe. I'll go with you."
His voice softens and I give him a small smile. If Cash goes with me, the narrow window I have to tell Henry about Caroline closes, and I know that. But Henry would never go. By making the decision to invite Cash, I'm inadvertently making the decision to leave Henry out. My brain reasons this out almost subconsciously. The justification follows just as fast. Henry will have to work. Henry will be busy. Henry won't want to go.
When? My brain is 3 steps behind my mouth.
You should call her first.
Cash looks startled that I haven't thought of that before, and I feel my cheeks flush. He checks his watch. I'm sure he thinks surreptitiously, but he scoots forward, restive, crossing and uncrossing his ankle over his knee.
Okay.
I squint at her photo again, the sun glinting off the high gloss. I'll call her today.
Zoe, I don't know how to say this, but you seem like someone who can handle things.
She might
not want to see you. It happens a lot. Just be prepared for that.
But if she agrees to see you, give me a call. I'll go with you. I've done it before.
You have?
Yeah, a few times. People don't like to do this alone, and sometimes I was the only person in their lives who knew. From that series, remember?
Like me, I say softly, and that stab of guilt is back like a hot poker, reminding me that I'm a liar. I'm lying to my husband. I mouth the words to myself to see how they feel. But it's not so bad. Technically, I've always lied to him. I stand abruptly, and a few pages slide out of the manila folder. Cash bends to pick them up.
I'll call you, okay?
Oh, Zoe, wait.
He holds out a folded-up newspaper.
It ran today. It's a good spread. Take a look. Give me a call. We'll talk.
I stare at the newspaper, and it takes me a minute to figure it out. Care. The event seems aged and distant. I shove it clumsily under the file in my arms and force a smile.
I'll call you, okay?
I say it again, turn and rush through the crowd. The sun suddenly seems too bright, a glaring carnival spotlight. A man on a unicycle swerves in and out of park benches, tipping his hat for money. I glance over my shoulder, and Cash is heading east, his hands in his pockets, his head tipped back, black hair glinting as he looks at the treetops. For what? I don't know. Before I can lose my nerve, I pull out my cell phone, flip the folder open with one hand, locate her current phone number. I dial.
Hello?
An impatient female voice picks up and I clear my throat. Hi, is this Caroline? There is a whoosh, like she's rubbed the pad of her thumb over the mouthpiece.
That depends. Are you selling me something?
No.
Then,
sure, I'm Caroline. Her voice is tired, worn thin like we're talking into 2 tin cans and a string. I open and close my mouth, stuck on what to say next. I feel like that children's book with the bird asking the bulldozer, "Are you my mother?"
Hi, my name is Zoe Whittaker. Do you know Evelyn Lawler?
Who is this again?
She's sharp now like broken glass. I'm Evelyn's daughter. Well, her adopted daughter.
I stop then because the next logical thing to say is, I'm your daughter. But I can't actually say that because it sounds too hokey, like an awful movie. So I stand there in silence and watch the park. The unicycle man is chasing a screaming tow-headed boy who clings to his mother's skirt. An oversized yellow helium balloon drunkenly weaves up toward the clouds. 2 men are arguing in what sounds like Polish over a chessboard.
What is your name again?
Her voice has dropped to a whisper.
Zoe Whittaker?
One of the men stands up and pounds the board with his fist. He turns and stalks off. His partner leans back in his chair, a satisfied grin on his face. We make eye contact.
Vigram, eh?
He points to his chest and shrugs his shoulders. I realize that Caroline hasn't spoken.
Hello, I say.
I'm here.
Would you meet with me? I'd come to you.
I feel like I'm ambushing her, but I'm panicky. I can feel my only tether slipping through my fingers like that goddamn yellow balloon. I look up, and it's a speck now, so high I can barely see it.
Can I think about it?
I'll call you back in an hour. She hangs up. No goodbye. Just click. Gone. I stare at the phone in my hand. The chess man gives me a good-natured shrug and ambles away. I wander back to the benches. I don't want to go home. The park seems as good a place as any.
I'm nowhere near Henry's office building or our apartment. When Henry and I were dating, he brought me here, to Washington Square Park, on a day like this. It was warmer, maybe May. The mosquitoes had settled into